This is a CBC podcast.
CBC podcasts are supported by HP Print Studio. Express your brand with HP Print Studio. Find free, customized templates to build your business identity, like letterhead, business cards, and shipping labels. Start the journey at www.hp.ca/print.
Hello, and welcome to the podcast version of the Vinyl Cafe. We publish a new podcast every weekend. You can download the latest or subscribe to the Vinyl Cafe podcast at cbc.ca/podcasting.
They left on a Monday morning at the beginning of September, 7:30 a.m., the annual grade 8 trip to Quebec City. 7:30 in the morning and the entire neighborhood was revved up. All the mothers and fathers. You would have thought they were leaving for war. Jenny Moore, poor Peter's mother, hovering by the bus with her eyes full of tears and her hands full of Kleenex. And Jenny wasn't the only one crying, just the most obvious. Jenny, ping-ponging from one teacher to another. Would they remember Peter was allergic to eggs? Was there a bathroom on the bus? She'd given him $60. Yes, she knew it was supposed to be 40, but the extra 20, just in case. Peter was already on board. Peter clambered onto the bus the moment it arrived. Murphy was second. And when Murphy found out about the extra $20, which, excuse me, what do you think? He found out about right away. When Murphy found out, he reappeared out the front door like a boll weevil. And he used the information to pry an additional $20 from his father. All the parents gathered around all the kids with their fancy backpacks ignoring them. Brothers and sisters, a nanny or two, and Mark Portnoy on the edge of it all looking lost. The only kid who came by himself. The only kid carrying his stuff in a plastic bag. Before you knew it, it was time to go. The kids bouncing around the seats at the back of the bus. Parent volunteers settling into the ones at the front, and Mr. Reynolds with his clipboard sticking his head out the front door. Mr. Reynolds looking up and down the street uncertainly, and sure enough, here they come. Dave and Sam running down the street. Backpacks slapping their thighs, Arthur barking as he tries to keep up. Sorry, puffed Dave when they got there, the alarm didn't go. Dave had actually volunteered to be one of the parent supervisors. Mr. Reynolds had demurred. Oh, lied Mr. Reynolds when Dave had called. That's very kind, but we already have a full complement. Put me down as a backup, said Dave. Over my dead body, thought Mr. Reynolds. After months of anticipation and weeks of planning, they were finally ready. Parents standing on either side of the bus waving at kids they couldn't see through the tinted windows. And then, when the bus finally pulled away, the two groups of parents suddenly finding themselves waving at each other. Everyone cracked up, waved even harder, and then walked down the street in twos and threes. Everyone except for Peter's mom, who sprinted to the next corner so she could catch the bus as it turned at the end of the block. Poor Jenny Moore, waving all by herself at no one at all. The only person who saw her was 22-year-old Pierre Massicotte, second-year Sciences Sociales at l'Université de Laval. Pierre was sitting in the jump seat in the stairwell to the driver's right, and Pierre was too preoccupied to pay Jenny Moore any mind. Pierre was going over and over the speech that he had been preparing all week. It began like this. We're going on a fantastic trip, and I want you to leave everything you know behind you. I want you to pretend that we're in a boat, not a bus, and I want you to pretend that we have just left France. And just like the French people in the 17th century who climbed into their boats, we don't know where we're going or what's going to happen to us. Pierre was their student guide, and this was his first ever student trip. He had put a lot of thought and effort into his presentation. He waited until the bus hit the highway, and he stood up and he reached for the mic. He took in a deep breath. We are going to Nouvelle-France, he said, and we're going to be there for 4 days. I want you to be adventurers. I want you to give me your five senses for 4 days. Instead of the rapt audience he'd imagined, Pierre was greeted with the sounds of candy wrappers ripping, pop cans popping, Game Boys buzzing, leaky iPods, and snoring from one of the parent volunteers. Murphy turned to Sam and said, "Last year they went to the IMAX. Do you think we'll get to go to the IMAX?" The only people listening to Pierre were two girls sitting way up front who were, oui, monsieur, right from the start, and who were now poring over Will Ferguson's Canadian History for Dummies, apparently checking his facts. It was not the reception Pierre had imagined, but Pierre didn't give up. Pierre kept going. The food we're going to eat is not the same as your parents' food. I want you to taste the food. The houses are not your parents' houses. They're made of stone. I want you to touch the stone walls. They were built by the French and the British 200, 300 years ago. I want you to smell the horses and buggies and the smells coming out of the horses. Someone at the back of the bus made a fart noise and everyone laughed. He'd lost them. He wasn't getting them back, and he knew it. It was late afternoon before they closed in on Quebec, North America's only walled city, and New York's only rival for best skyline anywhere, anytime. The breathtaking stone turrets and towers of the Chateau Frontenac guard the cliffs and cobblestones of old Quebec like an ancient castle, the Gibraltar of America. Everyone was pressed to a window as the bus rolled onto the Quebec Bridge. Pierre reached for the microphone. "Longest cantilevered bridge in the world," said Pierre. He waited until they were high above the river, about halfway across, and added, as if it was just an afterthought, "It's collapsed twice." It was the first reaction Pierre got all afternoon. Their hotel was a pension inside the walls of the old city, the floors uneven and the stairways narrow. There was an elevator with a frayed green carpet with gold fleur-de-lis, but the elevator looked as old as the city, and the fleur-de-lis were like little worn moths. No more than two people with suitcases could ride in the elevator at the same time, and everyone except the two girls from the front of the bus banged their suitcases up the stairs. They were billeted 4 to a room, 2 to a bed. They had half an hour to settle into their rooms and argue about who was going to sleep with whom. Then they were to meet in the lobby. There were signs on their beds that said, "Phone the front desk if you need more pillows." They felt like royalty. It took about 5 minutes before they stopped answering the phone at the front desk. When they went downstairs, Pierre circled them up in the lobby. "We have an hour before dinner," he said. "Go explore. No one go alone, and not beyond the Porte Saint-Jean or Rue Saint-Anne." They couldn't believe it. Sure, most of them had been away from their parents before. A lot of them had even been to camp. But at camp, there was always someone watching. At camp, they never dropped you in some town and let you wander around unsupervised. It was beyond the realm of their imaginations. They stood in the lobby for a moment in shock, and then off they went. The shy ones stuck to the teachers, but most of them headed off in groups of twos and threes. Peter Moore was like a cat let off a leash. "Come on," he said. Murphy and Sam followed him out the front door of the hotel and down the street. Murphy led them into the first dépanneur they saw. "I want to get some Red Bull for tonight," said Murphy. "Look at this," said Peter. Peter was holding the biggest plastic troll doll they'd ever seen, maybe 2 feet high with bright orange hair that stuck out in all directions, its troll hands perched on its hips. Peter said, "Watch this." The troll's eyes lit up and began to flash. "There's a button on the back of its head," said Peter. "It's only $21. At 5 o'clock, they gathered in the hotel lobby and marched off like just another army set on conquering Quebec. Up the Côte de la Fabrique, along Rue du Trésor. They stopped at Champlain's statue in the Place d'Armes and then headed along Rue Saint-Louis. Pierre pulled up in front of a little stone house with a steep red roof. Built in 1677, he said as they marched into a restaurant that was much too good for them. Prefixé, bœuf bourguignon, salad and dessert. "This meat looked like dog food," called a voice from the back. Less than half of them ate their stew, but they all devoured their dessert, sugar pie. At 10 o'clock that night, Mr. Reynolds went from room to room checking everyone was present and accounted for. He had a roll of masking tape in his pocket. As he left each room, he tossed the masking tape in the air and caught it. "I'm putting a strip of tape across your door," he said. Then he told them about the all-night security guard. If the guard saw the tape on their door was broken, he would know they had left their room. They didn't want to know how much trouble they'd be in if that happened. "Is the guard armed?" asked Peter Moore. "He has a Kalashnikov," said Mr. Reynolds. "Then, lights off at 10:30, right?" "Yes, Mr. Reynolds. Yes, sir. We're pretty tired, sir." "Good night, boys. Good night, Mr. Reynolds." 10:30? As if. There wasn't a light out by 2:30. There was much too much to do. In Eleanor Michelin's room, four little girls had set up a spa and were attempting to turn the bathroom into a steam room by running the shower at full tilt. Two floors above in room 421, Mark Portnoy, the only kid with a bed to himself, was about to show his three goggle-eyed roommates who were sleeping in the other bed how to make a blowtorch with a can of hairspray and a cigarette lighter in the shape of a cannon that he had bought on the Rue Saint-Jean. There was a marathon Xbox tournament getting underway in the room below them, and on the top floor, in Sam and Murphy's room, there was a 2-foot troll being lowered out the window on the curtain sash. At any moment, it was going to come even with the window of the girls' room one floor below, its red eyes flashing menacingly. All of this, of course, was happening behind the tape doors. So at 11 o'clock, when Pierre reported to Mr. Reynolds that all was quiet, Mr. Reynolds nodded and said, "You can go then." Mr. Reynolds took a look down the hotel corridor. He wasn't naive enough to believe everyone was asleep. But as long as the kids were in their rooms, Mr. Reynolds was going to try his best not to think too hard about what might be happening in them. If he had stepped outside for a moment, and if he had looked at the hotel from the street, he would have seen that the Pension de Vieux Québec was lit up like a party ship. There was steam billowing from one bathroom, what looked like a flamethrower belching occasionally from the third floor, and a troll with flashing eyes dancing around in the night sky. Mr. Reynolds missed all this, however, and he was sound asleep by midnight, which was when Charlotte Groves got bored of her pedicure and picked up the remote control and discovered Channel 2. The blue channel. And Eleanor Michelin worked out how you could phone from room to room without going through the switchboard. And word spread like wildfire. And pretty soon every television in every room was switched to Channel 2. And the educational component of the trip to Quebec began in earnest. "That's not real, is it?" said Peter Moore, moving closer to the television. The next morning, Peter snuck back to the dépanneur during breakfast and spent every last cent of his lunch money on trolls. When Sam and Murphy came back upstairs to clean up, Peter had his trolls, all sizes and shapes, lined up on the windowsill like soldiers. There were 17 of them. "Peter," said Murphy, "I can't believe you've done this. What are you going to do for food?" Peter didn't care. It was hours until lunch. Peter was lost on Planet Troll. "Look at this one," said Peter. "Isn't it cool?" "Come on," said Sam. They were supposed to be in the lobby. They followed Pierre through Place d'Armes and past the chateau and onto the wide wooden boardwalk suspended high above the river. To the east, in the lee of the Ile d'Orléans, you could see the great colonies of snow geese had begun to gather. Pierre was about to stop and point them out. From this distance, they looked like slashes of snow on the shore. Then he decided to let it pass, thinking, as he kept walking, that winter was closer than he thought. It was in the Jardin du Gouverneur that he had his brainstorm. "Come on," he said. And off they stormed to the Plains of Abraham. "Venez, venez, dépêchez-vous," said Pierre. He divided them into two armies and assigned them all roles. Murphy was Governor General Vaudreuil. Pierre, the Intendant Bigot. Sam was General Wolfe. "What are we doing?" asked Murphy. "We're going to recreate the battle," said Pierre. "You," he said, pointing at Mark Portnoy, "you can be the Marquis de Montcalm." "I don't want to be Montcalm," said Mark. "He lost. We what?" said Pierre. "Who do you mean, we?" Mark Portnoy shrugged. "Canada," he said. "Canada," said Pierre. "There was no Canada then." They were standing on the green plains of Abraham, just outside the walls of the citadel. For the first time, he had everyone's attention. "This wasn't," said Pierre, sweeping his arm around him, "this wasn't a battle between English Canada and French Canada. There was no English Canada. There were British ships and British troops. Were they the Canadian Army? They weren't the Canadian Army. There was no Canadian Army. This was a European war that they fought here. Canada came later. Canada hadn't been invented, not yet." They refought the battle three times, everyone jumping and shooting and whooping around. Twice the British won, and once, to make it fair, the French carried the day. Mark Portnoy stomping around with his fist in the air. After the battle, Murphy, all grass-stained and sweaty, ran up to Pierre. "That was pretty cool," said Murphy, "but are we going to the IMAX? Last year they went to the IMAX." "Tomorrow," said Pierre, defeated. "We're going to the IMAX tomorrow." Murphy pumped his fist in the air. "Yes," said Murphy. This was going to be the highlight of the trip. NASCAR 3D with French subtitles. They left for the theater the next morning at 10. As they staggered onto the bus, Sam wheeled around and looked at Murphy. "I forgot my wallet," he said, patting his back pocket. "I'll be right back." He peeled up to their room and he bounded back through the lobby as fast as he could. But it was four floors up and four floors down, and when he hit the sidewalk, he stopped in his tracks. He couldn't believe his eyes. The bus had left without him. Murphy should have stopped it, of course. But Murphy panicked. When the bus pulled away, Murphy thought Sam must have got on. He must be at the front. And then when they did attendance, and Sam clearly hadn't got on, when Mr. Reynolds called Sam's name and Sam didn't answer, Murphy did what he thought was the best thing under the circumstances. He answered for him. "Present," called Murphy. He was trying to keep Sam out of trouble. And it worked, sort of. Except it left Sam all alone on Rue Saint-Jean in trouble. Sam stood there in front of the hotel for about 5 seconds, felt a surge of panic, and then Sam did the one and only thing he could think of doing. He started running in the direction the bus had been pointing. There was a red light, and he spotted it a block away, but the light changed and the bus accelerated, and even though he did too, even though fueled by fear and his desire not to miss the movie, even though Sam ran harder than he'd ever run in his life, running even when he couldn't see the bus anymore, he lost it and eventually pulled up, standing in the middle of a block, bent over, his hands on his thighs, a spent little NASCAR clean out of fuel. When he straightened up, he saw a policeman on the other side of the street, and he almost asked the policeman the way to the theater, but it occurred to him, the policeman wouldn't just give him directions. The policeman would make calls, and he would for sure get in trouble. So he didn't ask the policeman. He asked the boy carrying the skateboard. It was only after he asked that he realized the boy with the skateboard was a girl. And by then, she was as confused as he was, because as far as this little girl understood, this odd-looking boy that she had never seen before had just asked her on a date to the IMAX. He had used his best French, but it had come out garbled, and "Quoi?" said the girl he thought was a boy. Sam wanted to start running again, but it was too late to start running again, and anyway, where was he going to run to? So he tried again. The girl was leaning forward, looking at him really hard, and then she said, "Ah." And she started talking in French, and she was going so fast he didn't understand a word, not one word. And she must have seen that, because she stopped talking. And she said, "C'est trop difficile. It's too far from here. You can't do it. It's much too difficile." "I have to," said Sam. "Everyone's there. I can't miss it. Everyone's there." His voice cracked. "It's the best thing of the trip." He was still out of breath. He was thinking, "I am not going to cry. I can't cry." The girl shrugged. "C'est difficile," she said again. "May I could show you there." And he wasn't sure, but maybe she reached out and wiped a tear off his cheek. Or maybe he just wanted her to. She was wearing black boots and brown army pants, way too big for her, and a baggy jacket, and they were walking beside each other, and she was saying, "Where are you to?" And he said, "The movie theater." And she looked at him funny, and he understood that she meant from. Where was he from? And he said, "Toronto. I'm from Toronto." And she said, "I'm so sorry." And then she was climbing up on the wall that went around the city, and he was standing there below her. He didn't know what to say, so he said, "I'm on a school trip." And she said, "Je sais, je sais." And they stared at each other without moving, and she waved her arms in exasperation and said, "Viens, viens, it's okay." And before he knew it, they were walking along the old stone wall of the city, 30 feet in the air, the street on their left, the river on their right, like they were walking along railway tracks. Sam said, "We drove past this yesterday." And then he told her about the Plains of Abraham and the museum and Peter's trolls, talking to her back because she was ahead of him by a couple of steps, telling her how he had left his wallet in his room. And she slowed down, and they were walking beside each other, and she said, "Did you see the cannonball in the tree?" And he said, "Which one?" And she stopped talking, and she said, "It's super cool." And she jumped off the wall, and the way she jumped, holding her skateboard over her head, was almost as cool as the way she had said, "Super cool." And he stood there staring at her, and she said, "Viens." And he jumped, and they ran down the narrow cobbled street hand in hand. Well, that's how he imagined they ran. Really, she ran in front of him, and he had to push to keep up. Sam had forgotten all about the IMAX. "Tiens," she said, pointing. And sure enough, it was a cannonball at the edge of a narrow lane, the roots of a tree gnarled around it. He smiled at her and he said, "Super cool." Then he said, "I was General Wolf in the battle." And then he remembered she was French, and he felt awkward, and he added, "It was a play. Montcalm won once." And she said, "I saw Montcalm's skull." The way she said it, he knew it was true. Though the truth is, he would have believed anything she said to him. But the skull of Montcalm. He was so mesmerized, he started speaking fluent French. "Ooh," he said. And the most magical thing happened. She understood him. She said, "Au musée des Sœurs Ursulines." And off they went again, over another cobblestone hill, to another museum to see the skull of Louis-Joseph le Marquis de Montcalm. When they got there, Sam said, "Moi, je n'ai jamais vu un crâne." Well, actually, he said, I've never seen a skull. But talking to her, it felt like he was saying it in French. When they got to the museum, the woman in the ticket booth said, we don't have it anymore. They buried it with his troops in the Bastille 5 years ago. Too bad, said the girl. It was a cute skull. Sam said, c'est fait rien. She said, veux-tu un chocolat chaud? Oui, he said, noticing with relief that he had his French back. They went into a little cafe on Rue Couillard. She had a coffee that came in a little cup. His hot chocolate was served in a bowl. Sam didn't know how you were supposed to drink hot chocolate when it came in a bowl. To be safe, he went to the counter and got a spoon and ate it like soup. She wanted to ask, is that the way the English do it? But she didn't want him to think she was ignorant. The rest of his manners seemed perfect. Maybe they did it wrong. Instead, she said, aimes-tu Daniel Bélanger? Sam said, j'aime Avril Lavigne. They had to take a bus to the theater. They sat at the back of the bus. He could feel her leg against his. He couldn't think of anything to say to her, so they barely said anything at all. It took about a half an hour. When they got there, the big tour bus was parked outside. Sam said, that's my bus. There were kids getting on it. She said, I think you missed your movie. Sam said, I can't miss my bus. All he wanted to do in all the world was kiss her. He had never done that before. They stared at each other. That's what she wanted, too. She wanted him to lean forward and kiss her goodbye. They shook hands. It was so tragic. But as he got up, he kissed the air in her general direction. Murphy said the movie was amazing. Murphy said, I can't believe you missed it. It was the best thing I've ever seen. Sam was looking out the bus window. The girl was standing there with her skateboard under her arm, her head to the side. Sam said, I'll see it another time. He lifted his hand and waved tentatively. She was looking right at him, squinting right at him, but she didn't wave back. She couldn't see him through the tinted windows. So he brought his hand up to his lips and blew her a kiss. If he was older, he would have asked her name or her email or something. And if she was older, he wouldn't have had to ask. But he didn't know anything about her, really, except she had seen Montcalm's skull, and he didn't. The last moment Sam saw her, Murphy was sitting beside him, telling him something about the movie, but he wasn't really listening. He had his face pressed to the window. He said something under his breath, and Murphy said, I can't hear you. And Sam said, nothing, it's okay. And then he turned back to the window and he said it again. Au revoir, he said. Salut. And then just before they turned the corner, she blew him a kiss. He leaned back in his chair and sighed. His first kiss. And it was a French kiss. And she was his first girlfriend ever. Thank you.
That was Stuart McLean, and that's from the Vinyl Cafe. In December, Stuart will be touring his annual Christmas concert, making stops in places like Sarnia, Vancouver, Victoria, Calgary, Banff, Edmonton, Regina, Barrie, London, Kitchener, Ogdensburg, New York, Ottawa, and Massey Hall in Toronto. You can check the website to find out if they're coming to your town. You can find the Vinyl Cafe on the web at vinylcafe.com.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.